Okay, so let us carry on where we left off just before the meal this morning. And we were looking at this idea of the cessation, the ending of perception, and this Wandari Potapada saying, giving various ideas of how perception comes to an end, or where it ceases, some very strange ideas about God's kind of pulling the perception out of you and these kind of things. And then he says, which I think is very nice, he comes to the Buddha and asks the Buddha, well, what do you have to say about this Blessed One? He calls him Blessed One, which is kind of, obviously for a wanderer, that's kind of high praise for the Buddha in that particular case. So how does the cessation of perception happen? And now we come to the Buddha's reply. So this is getting very exciting now. See what the Buddha has to say about this. And this is how the Buddha starts out. He says, regarding this Potapada, those ascetics and Brahmins who say that the person's perception arises without cause or reason are wrong from the start. Why is that? Because a person's perceptions arise and cease with cause and reason. With training, certain perceptions arise and certain perceptions cease. Yeah, so they are wrong from the start. In other words, that's the first thing they say, and from the very beginning they kind of get it wrong. That's what the Buddha is saying there. And the Buddha's reply is obviously correct. Yeah, we kind of know this already. Because perception is basically how we, as I mentioned before, how we relate to the world, how we're able to distinguish anything, how we're able to know anything at all. Perception is like one of the most basic faculties of the mind, the ability to understand things. And we know that this changes all the time. We know that when you, for example, some days you might not be very happy and the world kind of seems grey and drab because you're kind of feeling a bit miserable or whatever. And another day you might feel really wonderful. And the most kind of grey day even seems beautiful, even even though it's quite kind of grey and overcast outside. And so we know that how our mind state, how we enter, how we kind of come to our life, how we approach our life or whatever, actually depends a lot, varies from day to day. And our perception, our feelings about the world, how we relate to those things, then depend on that kind of mental state that we are in at that time. So our perceptions are very, very varied. And you will notice that when you practice something like the Buddhist path, that your attitude to things start to change. You start to think about people in a new way. Very often when we start out in the world, we may get upset with people very easily because we see someone as an enemy or we see someone as a bad person, and we think it is right to have ill will even. Self-righteousness is good, or having ill will. Of course you're going to have ill will when people go around invading other countries or killing others. It's right to get angry in those kind of situations. And then you reflect about the nature of reality, you reflect about the word of the Buddha, and you realize maybe it isn't right. Maybe I was wrong about that in the first place. And then you start to think about the world in a different way. You start to see people more like conditioned phenomena. They're not really independent. The way they act really depends on all kind of things in the world. And when you see that, you start to see people in a different way, and you just don't get upset anymore in the same way you did before. In fact, you start to have often more compassion for people, even the perpetrators of the crimes in the world, let alone the victims. So our perceptions of the world, how we relate to things, is always changing. And it specifically changes in the way the Buddha is talking about here. It changes with our development of the path. As you develop the path, you see things in new ways. You relate to things in new ways. And this is the changing of perception that we're talking about. So that is kind of what the Buddha is talking about here. This changing malleability of perception. Perception is just one of many, of a number of mental faculties. Sometimes in the suttas you see the Buddha talking about three specific things. He talks about perception, thought, and views. Yeah, and in the commentaries it is pointed out how these three things are very closely related to each other. The most basic of these three things is really perception. As soon as you open your eyes, as soon as you see something or you hear something, there is a perception that goes with that. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to make any sense of what's going on. Yeah, the ability to distinguish again, the ability to make things out around you. Perception is almost immediate. It's like, bang, it's a given. And then once you have a perception, yeah, you see a person, okay, that's a really nice person. I really like them. That's kind of your perception. You get very happy when you see this person, yeah, whoever that might be. I don't know who makes you happy, but whoever that is, the Buddha, maybe, I don't know. not always the Buddha, yeah, some people see something, the ice cream man, they get very happy. But so it varies. And then, because the ice cream man, you think, yeah, ice cream man, it's a hot day, hooray, maybe the ice cream woman, I'm not sure what the gender balance is these days between ice cream people, but they, so you, and then, because you perceive the ice cream person as something that makes you happy, you think about them in a positive way. Yeah, you think, wow, yeah, that's so nice, yeah, coming around, okay, they make a bit of living for themselves and then they kind of supply us with ice cream. You think about them in a positive way. If you're more kind of advanced on the spiritual path, yeah, you think, yeah, the Buddha, wow, what a wonderful thing it is that I'm kind of able to have such a teacher, yeah, in the background behind everything. So you think about the Buddha in a very kind of, you know, you feel really good about being the Buddha's disciple. And then as you perceive and think in this way, then you develop your views about these things. The views kind of come out of this, yeah? The views are influenced by how we think and how we perceive in the world. So we have this view about the Buddha being someone special. And then the Buddha, once that view is in place, that view again influences our perceptions. So it goes round and round like this, and we're kind of trapped in this loop of perceptions, thoughts, and views, always kind of holding each other in place. And it's very hard to break that circularity because it is a kind of loop that always revolves around. When we talk about developing perceptions, how can that happen then if there is this circularity where everything is kind of locked in place by other mental factors? And the way it happens is because it starts out with view. Yeah, when you read the suttas, what you are really doing is that you're learning a different viewpoint. You're seeing the world from a different point of view. You're seeing the world from the Buddha's point of view. And as you do that, you either reject it, in which case it doesn't have any effect on you. But if you think, yeah, this is a very interesting viewpoint, then your view is starting to align with the view of the Buddha. And because your view is aligning with the word of the Buddha, you start to perceive the world in that way. Yeah, the Buddha says, look at it this way. Yeah, people don't really know what they're doing. They're walking around in darkness. They are deluded. Maybe we should have compassion for everyone. The Buddha is said to have this maha karuna. Karuna is compassion in Pali. Maha is great compassion because his compassion is universal for all beings. Yeah, and this is then what happens. So you start to, your view changes, then that influences your perceptions. And then your perceptions then again influence your thoughts, which again reinforce the views. And then gradually you kind of build a different perception. You're coming out of this. But it starts with views, and this is what we will start see very soon. Very soon here we talk about how the Buddha comes into the world, the arising of the Buddha, as it's slightly mystically called. Yeah, the arising of the Buddha in the world, and then that how that leads to this beautiful Buddhist path, the Noble Eightfold Path, eventually going all the way to awakening itself. In other words, the view comes into the world, and it changes our perceptions of things. We look at things in a new way. We think about, we learn to think in a new way. And we develop all of these mental factors in a wholesale transformation of the mind. The mind, all the factors of the mind, all the faculties of the mind, changing according to these amazing teachings of the Buddha. So this is kind of the idea of developing perceptions. Yeah, we use our views. We also use our thinking process to think about things. Yeah, reflection, you can call it. It is not necessarily a very coarse kind of thinking. It can just be very light thinking. What does the Buddha mean about this? Yeah, and sometimes it just sinks in. Oh, that's what it means. Okay, wow, that's really interesting. Yeah. And then you kind of your things kind of your mental outlook changes accordingly. There is an interesting little sutta, which I maybe should have included here. It's in the numerical discourse. It's in the fours. Actually, I have it right here, I think. Let's have a look. I should have it here. And this little sutta is precisely about perception. Yeah, because you don't see maybe that much discussion of perception in the suttas. But what this little sutta says is that it is a discussion between Venerable Ananda and Venerable Sariputta. And Venerable Ananda asked Venerable Sariputta, yeah, in case you don't know Venerable Sariputta, the Buddha's right-hand monk, yeah, and he asks him, what is the reason why some beings are not fully extinguished in the present life? And then he asked the opposite, why is that some beings are fully extinguished in the present life? Fully extinguished means that you attain Nibbana, right? You attain the very end of the path. So what is the cause for attaining the end of the path? And of course, you can say that there's many ways you can say this. Yeah, you can say, well, you practice the Noble Eightfold Path, you gain samadhi, you have insight, etc., etc. But of course, one of the really nice things about Venerable Sariputta is that he often says things in a different way that you're not used to. There's all these suttas where he analyzes the text in ways that are not actually found anywhere else. That is the cool thing about Venerable Sariputta. I always like to point out that when you see in the iconography, yeah, how the Buddha and his disciples are presented in statues, that sort of thing, yeah, iconography, you find that Venerable Sariputta is the only monk who has a different posture from everyone else. Yeah, and all the other monks, they usually have their hands in Anjali, from Mahamoggallana all the way down to the most junior monks, which is people like myself and Venerable Kaliko, with the latest kind of on the on the tree of Buddhism. And all the monks are like this, yeah? Except for Venerable Sariputta. You know his posture? It's like this. There's like a certain kind of confidence about Venerable Sariputta. And when you have a shrine, you should always, if you see a monk like that, you know straight away that's Venerable Sariputta, you should always place him on the right-hand side of the Buddha. In other words, this side of the Buddha. And the other monks, or Venerable Mahamoggallana, should be on the other side. You can check out the shrine, and people who don't know how to put shrines up properly, they might get the reverse, yeah? So then you can go and tell them how to do it properly. No, don't do that. You might get into trouble. Just an idea. But that's kind of refinements of kind of Buddhist etiquette, if you like. Yeah. So what does he say, this Venerable Sariputta? And what he says, which is interesting here, he says that the person who becomes fully extinguished is someone who knows. Yeah, it's always about knowledge. And because it is about knowledge, it's a kind of view. Someone who knows which perceptions lead to decline, which perceptions lead to standing still, which perceptions lead to progress. Yeah, or it is here called this distinction, visesa, and which perceptions lead to breakthrough, nibbedika, breaking through to the Dhamma, to full understanding of these teachings. Yeah. So in a sense, it is about right view, but it's right view about perceptions. You know straight away when you perceive the world, is this a perception which leads down the drain or down anyway? Is this a perception that kind of makes me not go anywhere? Is this a perception that actually leads to progress? You know that. And of course, it's kind of obvious. Yeah, if you see someone and you kind of have a negative feeling about the person, a negative perception, that is a perception that leads to decline, because it leads to anger, it leads to defilements, it leads to problems. If you have a perception of the world, you think, actually, I'm really fed up of this world, there's too much war and too much problems, there's no solution in this world, that's a perception that likely leads to progress, because it will allow you to access samadhi if you develop that kind of perception. Yeah, and the perception that leads to complete breakthrough, well, that's a perception that has to do with seeing the five khandhas in the right way. That's kind of a cool way of thinking about things. So you understand your mind, you know what is happening in your mind, you know whether it is something useful or not, or something that destabilizes you or whatever. You know that, and because you know that, you can change. You can look at things in a different way. You can take remedial action, as they say, yeah? And you can kind of go in a different direction. We need to know the difference between good and bad. If you don't know that, there's nothing we can do. So this is really, really important. And a large part of this happens also through meditation practice. Yeah, that's where often we find out. You go deeper in meditation and think, wow, this is really good. So all this other stuff I had before was actually not so good. Yeah, you start to understand the mental states that are very useful and very powerful. This is what, when we talk about development of perception, it is really just another development of the mind. Development of views and all of these kind of things. And it's an aspect of this whole mental development that we are thinking of. That is what the Buddha says, that with training, certain perceptions arise, certain perceptions cease. And what is that training? Said the Buddha. So now we come to the beginning of the gradual training. All the way from the beginning to the very end. And this is what it looks like in so many different suttas. And so we're going to have a look at this gradual training in quite a bit of detail. And all the answers to the question of the cessation of perception and all of this is going to come at the very end of the sutta. So you have to be really patient. You have to hang in there. So it's a good reason to kind of stay. Even if you have a bit of dukkha on the retreat, you kind of stay because you want to hear the ending of the sutta. That's kind of that's my evil plan. So please forgive me for that. So this is how it starts out. So let's see what the Buddha says. And this is a completely standard way of phrasing things. It's when a realized one, a Buddha, arises in the world, perfected, a fully awakened Buddha, accomplished in knowledge and conduct, holy, knower of the world, supreme guide for those who wish to train, teacher of gods and humans, awakened, blessed. This is that famous verse, Iti piso bhagava arahang samma sambuddho vijja charana sampanno, etc. That's a very famous verse that Buddhists around the world chant a lot, and we chanted at Bodhinyana Monastery, at Dhammaloka Center, and all of these various places. This particular little verse here, this little particular little paragraph, is when you read the suttas, and the Buddha says we should reflect on the Buddha, we should contemplate the Buddha, what the Buddha is. This is what he says, this is what we should reflect on. Because this is what we should reflect on, and remember that the so-called Buddha Nusati, recollection of the Buddha, is one of the six ways of giving rise to joy in meditation. And joy then also overcoming the hindrances, allowing the mind to move to samadhi, the six Anusatis, the six recollections. So for that reason, it is actually a very important thing. And ideally, if you are able to reflect on the Buddha in the right way and to understand how extraordinarily fortunate anyone is to come in contact with the Buddha's teachings. If you can reflect on this in the right way, it gives you a foundation for your meditation practice, for giving access to these qualities that are so important for meditation to work. Sometimes you find people, they can become quite peaceful in the meditation. They can say, I'm becoming really peaceful. But actually, sometimes it stops with the peace. And they find it hard to give rise to joy and happiness. It's good to be peaceful, and it's wonderful that you can do that. But if you really want to take this path all the way, joy is a very important part of this practice. And this is then one of these ways of actually giving rise to this joy. It is not easy, necessarily. They say, I was speaking with Bokaluk about this yesterday, and of course it says that it is really the Aryas who can do this, like that. For them it's really easy. The noble people, they can do this kind of just like that. Why? Well, because they know the Dhamma. They know who the Buddha is. They know the kind of insight he has had. And because of that direct experience, they are able to give rise to joy very easily with these things. But that doesn't mean it's exclusively meant for the Aryas. It is also meant for everyone, except that it's a bit more, it's not as immediate for other people. So what is this contemplation that we should do? It's getting quite interesting, isn't it? So if we can gain some access to this. So the first thing it says here, a Buddha, the Bhagava realized one. Let's see what the Pali is for this. Tathagata, that's right, okay, Tathagata. Tathagata arises in the world. Yes, this is basically Buddha arising in the world. So what does it mean that the Buddha arises in the world? It kind of sounds a bit mysterious, doesn't it? Arise in the world, does that mean it's kind of like phoenix arising from the ashes? You know, it's kind of the old, actually, there's a phoenix on this retreat, so I have to be careful what I say. This is the Greek kind of mythology, the phoenix, the bird coming out of the ashes. What does it actually mean, arising in the world? And of course, the majority of Buddhists today, when they hear that, they will say, well, this is the idea of the Bodhisattva. And the Bodhisattva has been practicing for 4 incalculable eons, taking the original vow under the Buddha Dipankara, the ascetic Sumedha, who takes the, it's kind of how the story goes according to the Buddha Vamsa is one of the slightly obscure books of the Sutta Pitaka, much later books than the actual suttas. And so he takes his vow. He is the ascetic Sumedha, and then he gradually fulfilling that vow by practicing over 4 incalculable eons, he becomes the Buddha eventually. That's kind of the traditional story. It's important to realize that the idea of the Bodhisattva ideal is not just a Mahayana ideal. This ideal is also found in Theravada Buddhism. Not in the suttas, mind you, not in the suttas, but in the commentaries. So it is actually an important part of Theravada as well. And you'd be surprised how many people in the Theravada world actually take Bodhisattva vows. Yeah, you find monks, it's very common for monks, even people you think might be really super duper good monks. Yeah, and they, or I don't know about the nuns, whether they also do the same thing, but it's very common. And monks you would never think would come up with these sort of things, actually take these Bodhisattva vows. And to my mind, it's kind of hard to say, but to my mind it's actually quite misguided. It's actually, there's nothing in the suttas, nowhere does the Buddha say we should be practicing to become Buddhas. There's not a single sutta that says this. And when the Buddha lays down the path, it is always the Noble Eightfold Path. It is always the gradual training. He says, this is the path. This is what you should be doing. If you want to become enlightened, this is. If you want to be happy, this is what you should do. If you want to be miserable, don't do it. He doesn't say that. I'm adding a bit for just for fun. And that's what he presents to us. And then, of course, in Buddhist history, the idea of the Bodhisattva path arises. And there are some very interesting things written about that, why these things arose, how kind of it can, some of the seeds of this can be found in the suttas, in terms of, not because the actual Bodhisattva itself is mentioned in the suttas, but because certain things in the suttas that may be developed in that direction. And this is kind of what some of this research goes into, how it kind of arises out of certain seeds in the suttas. But actually, Buddha never says we should do this. There's not there. And to my mind, taking on the Bodhisattva vow, you're actually moving away from the teachings of the Buddha. You're not really respecting the Buddha. What you're saying is that I think that this is better, even though the Buddha didn't say it, I still think it's better, and so I'm going to do it. And it's a bit kind of, it's misguided, basically. And yet, it is surprising how many people in the world do this. And I think one of the reasons why people do it is precisely because they haven't really read the suttas properly. It is still quite rare in the world to really read the suttas. If you read the suttas properly and you read everything that is in there, cover to cover, like I have done a few times, in Pali, English, Norwegian, other languages, whatever it is, just to see variations on the theme, you start to realize that actually there's nothing really in there which said that you should do this. So why, how does the Bodhisattva ideal arise in the world? Why is there such a thing here? And it seems to be the case that, when after the Buddha passed away, people started to ask questions. Who was the Buddha? As soon as someone is gone, especially when someone who is so powerful as the Buddha was, when they are gone, it's like there's a vacuum in the Buddhist community. There's like something that needs to be filled. And if you haven't got the actual person, Well, at least we can have the history and the biography of that person to fill that vacuum that is there. And so people started to speculate. I think this is what happens very often, yeah? After people die, that's when you start writing biographies, and you see this even with great people at our times, people writing about all kinds of people who died 2,000 years ago. And then gradually this idea of the Bodhisattva ideal arose out of some very small, tiny kernel that never really implied the idea at all in the suttas. And it arose into this massive literature which has to do with the Bodhisattva ideal. On the one side, you have all the Jataka tales, the famous birth stories, and some of those are very interesting and very nice, and they're great as stories to tell, but not to be taken too seriously. Yeah, and they too were never really spoken by the Buddha. And on the other hand, you get this very famous specialized Buddhist literature, you get the Buddha Vamsa, of course, which is the lineage of the Buddha. You get the Charyapitaka, which is the basket of conduct. You get the, what else do you get? So you get all of these kind of things, and the Bodhisattva ideal arises out of all of that. And that's kind of natural for human beings to do this. But be careful, because taking on this ideal, as far as I'm concerned, is actually going against the teachings of the Buddha. If we want to be disciples of the Buddha, we should do what the Buddha says we should do, not kind of try to find our own path. And I can understand why it is very attractive to think to become a Buddha. Yeah, it's kind of beautiful to be able to help everyone in the world. It's a beautiful ideal. There's also a danger that the ego gets a little bit into it. Yeah, I don't want to be some dodgy arahant. I want to be the real deal, yeah, a Buddha. Of course, arahants aren't dodgy. Yeah, arahants are pretty amazing in their own right. But it sounds even better to be a Buddha. So it's very easy for the ego to sneak in a little bit and say, yeah, I want to be the real thing, not some kind of half-baked product. So for that reason, we have to be very, very, very careful with these things. So what then is the Buddha? What does it mean to be a Buddha? How does the Buddha actually come into being? If there is no path, and there is no mentioning of a path at all in the suttas for this, what is a Buddha then? The answer is that the Buddha is just any being in this world who happens to be practicing in the right way, who happens to come onto this path. And basically the path that they happen to be on is the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, that is the path to become a Buddha. It's exactly the same path as the path to become an arahant. Yeah, because that is how awakening happens, according to the suttas. But they happen on this path without really any structure. It is more just like, some people in this world are more virtuous than others. Some people in this world are wiser than others. And they just happen to practice the right way because of circumstances and nature. And occasionally, very occasionally, there will be a person who is... all the circumstances are right. Yeah, all the circumstances are just perfect. And then, as a consequence of that, they're able to find awakening. And that is how you get the Buddha arising in the world. So it's like... a Buddha is just like a natural phenomena. Yeah, it's like when you get enough causes coming together, you get a strong wind. And sometimes all the causes come together in such a way that the wind is extremely strong, and you get the strongest kind of typhoon or hurricane that you've had ever. Yeah, let's say in Perth or whatever. In the same way, sometimes all the conditions come together so powerfully that the outcome is like a Buddha, a fully awakened person. And of course, there are, if you look at the history of people who are samanas, there are many people who practice things like the jhanas and deep samadhi states and all of these kind of things. Yeah, and those people who practice that, they're already quite close to awakening. All they need is that final little thing that leads, the spark that kind of, makes the thing go off, and then you actually reach awakening itself. So Buddhas are basically natural phenomena. We are all natural phenomena, yeah? Every one of you, I am a natural phenomena. We're all natural phenomena. Are you okay with that, being a natural phenomenon? Yeah? It's all right, isn't it? Yeah? It doesn't feel like that. It feels like I'm a self, yeah? I'm kind of something more than a natural phenomenon. Not really. From Buddha's point of view, we're just this natural phenomenon walking around. natural phenomena of flesh and mind. So this is the idea of the Buddha arising. It just means that somehow someone is able, by all the cause and conditioning coming together, and they are able to make that breakthrough and see perfectly what the world is like. So they arise in the world, yeah? World. I'm just thinking, what does that mean here? It just means anywhere. It just probably means the human realm, actually, probably. But not necessarily. I'm not entirely sure about that. They are perfected. Yeah, this word for perfected is arahant. And the word arahant does not actually mean perfected. The word arahant means worthy. And the word arahant is a word that existed in India prior to the Buddhist teachings, prior before the Buddha. And it always meant someone who's worthy. And it had this implication of someone who has gone all the way to the end of the Buddhist path or to whatever spiritual path. That was the idea at the time. And so the Buddha, as he very often does, he takes on an existing word in that existing culture and uses that word in the context of Buddhism. So in Buddhism, then, it means someone who is perfectly, who has gone all the way to the end of the path. And they are perfected. So they are perfected, but they're also worthy. So what does it mean to be worthy? And the way I like to think about this is that someone is worthy of, you know, in the suttas we often talk about being worthy of offerings, worthy of hospitality, worthy of anjali, worthy of gifts, yeah. And that's kind of the standard way. So why are people worthy of gifts? Why are people worthy of hospitality? Why are people worthy of respect? And very often, because they give you something, yeah, they give you access to something that is very hard to get. Why do we respect a teacher? The reason we respect any teacher, and of course the respect for teacher will vary according to culture, but all cultures, we have some degree of respect for a teacher. Why is that? And the reason is because the teacher gives us access to understanding and information and knowledge that we need to survive in the world. Yeah. In other words, they give us access to a degree of happiness, if you like, or lack of suffering. Without that knowledge, we wouldn't be able to function. And if you can't function, it's a lot of suffering. So anyone who gives you access to some degree of happiness or reduction in problems or whatever, teachers, in other words, in this case, they are worthy of respect, of gifts. Yeah, they are worthy in one way or another. But of course, the highest teacher in the world is the Buddha. Because if other teachers give you access to understanding and knowledge and some degree of happiness, the highest happiness is only accessible through the Buddha himself. That is where we get access to the highest thing that everyone is interested in. And because he is able to give us the highest thing, then of course he is also the one who is most worthy of this these things in return. Yeah. Respect, generosity, and all of these kind of things. So this is what we mean by worthy. Is it truly worthy of these things in return? Because it is the highest kind of teacher who gives you access to the most important thing in the world. If someone can give you access to the highest kind of happiness, to the meaning of life, to all of these kind of things, that's kind of powerful, right? Kind of extraordinary. And once you start to get into this idea that the Buddha gives you access to something, to the very thing that you have always been looking for, to the thing that gives you the very meaning of life itself, the ending of all problems, it's kind of extraordinary when you think about that. It's actually hard to comprehend. That's why we don't kind of go up jumping for joy straight away, because we can't really comprehend it. If you really got it, you would straight away, you would kind of bliss out, because such an extraordinary thing that this is impossible. It's always interesting. You look at what drives, what motivates people in the world, and we are motivated by, I'm going to get myself a nice car. I'm going to work really hard, yeah? And you kind of work really hard for that. You're inspired, because then you're going to get something really nice. But it's nothing. Yeah, it is nothing compared to what the Buddha has on offer. This is immeasurably much more great than any kind of thing you can have in the world. And yet somehow, most people would be far more inspired, working far more harder, being much more motivated to get some kind of ordinary worldly thing than they are in practicing these teachings. is because we don't really understand what is on offer. We don't understand the profundity of these teachings. That is the problem, yeah? If we did, we would kind of put our hands in anjali and bow down to the Buddha all the time, and we would remain prostrate. I don't know. Something like that would happen, yeah? Because they think, whoa, this is just astonishing. Yeah? And people who really have very profound faith in the Buddha, they cry when they bow down to the Buddha, yeah? Tears of joy, because it is so powerful. That is really the kind of attitude that is, you know, shows a full understanding of what this is about. And this is what we mean by the Buddha being worthy. He's worthy because he gives us access to the most important thing in human existence. So this is one way of thinking about the Buddha as worthy. But the Buddha is worthy also here because he is perfected. What does it mean to be perfected? And perfected, there's two ways of thinking about perfected in Buddhism. And this is what you find when you become an arahant. You go all the way to the end of the Buddhist path. And the Buddha says you have two things that are the outcome of that Buddhist path. And one is called Cetto Vimutti, and one is called Panya Vimutti. And Cetto Vimutti means like liberation by mind, or liberation of mind. And the other one, Panya Vimutti, means liberation by wisdom. Panya is wisdom, Cetto is mind. So what is this? In what sense are we perfected here? And Cetto Vimutti, liberation by mind, means that the mind is freed from all those things that kind of confine you, that make the mind feel unpleasant, uncomfortable. These are all the defilements in the mind. Yeah, there's no more hindrances in the mind. There's no more defilements in the mind. There's no more delusion in the mind. The mind is free. The mind feels freed because all of these things that stop you from feeling free have been abandoned. Yeah, it's kind of very strange. We have a very wrong idea of freedom in the world. Our idea of freedom is this idea that we're going to go out and enjoy ourselves and do what we want. We do not want to be restrained by rules or by morality or anything like that. Because if you have morality, I can't do what I want, right? I've got to be kind if I have to be moral. Don't want to be kind all the time. I want to be naughty. Naughty. Yeah, good fun. More fun to be naughty. I'm not going to do really bad things, but I want to be a little bit naughty at least. But of course, that is not what real freedom is. Because inner freedom is the mind that actually is not limited by anything. A mind that has no measures. A mind that where you feel that you are in touch kind of with the whole world without having any limitations within you. That is the real freedom. That is a freedom that allows you to see clearly. That is a freedom that makes you gives you access to things like metta, compassion, all of these kind of things, all of these beautiful feelings and perception that we try to develop. And this is why this is called the liberation of the mind, liberation from these defilements. We had to be careful sometimes in Buddhism, because sometimes Buddhism, it phrases things in a very negative way. We talk about freedom from defilements, and you think, yeah, what's the big deal, freedom from defilements? But of course, it is a big deal, because freedom from defilements implies the opposite. It implies the presence of very, very powerful positive states. Yeah, so this is kind of the weird thing. We talk in this kind of negative way. We don't understand that actually the implications are very, very high positive states as well. And then there's the other side of being perfect. That is the perfection of wisdom. And that is the insight idea, understanding the nature of what exactly? The nature of the world, you could say. Or you could say the nature of the mind. Yeah, you can include the body if you wish, but especially the mind. And essentially, it comes down to one thing. And that is the understanding the nature of the five khandhas. We talked about the five khandhas already. Talk about, again, these five aspects of personality. Seeing those five khandhas in the right way. Yeah, this is understanding. This is liberation by wisdom. You see the nature of these things, yeah? And it means you understand their limitations, you understand their suffering, painful nature, yeah? So that you abandon those five khandhas down the track. Yeah? These are the two aspects of liberation in Buddhism: liberation by wisdom, liberation of mind. Cetto Vimutti, Panya Vimutti. Yeah? One is insight, one is like the freeing of the mind. We'll talk much more about this insight later on. That's what just in brief for you. So this is the idea of being an arahant, or just one way of thinking about the idea of arahant, perfected, fully awakened Buddha, Samma, Sambuddha. And this is a continuation of the idea of being an arahant. Buddha means an awakened one. Buddha means to be awake. It is one of these Indo-European words, and you find languages in the world today where the word Buddha is still used. I'm Buddha, I'm awake. That's literally what it says. So if you go to some of these countries, if someone says they're Buddha, don't take it, you know, the wrong way. It doesn't, don't start following them and kind of praise them. You're a Buddha. Wow. No, it just means that they're got up in the morning. That's all it means. Sambuddha. So similarly, a little bit similar to the idea of Panya Vimutti. You are awake to the world. You've seen things in the right way. And the Samma here means like completely, fully. It's kind of the idea that that we use in Buddhism to distinguish the Buddha from any other kind of spiritual teachers. But it also has an kind of more an implied meaning. And this is, in Buddhism, we talk about three kinds of awakened teachers, or three kinds of awakened beings. And this is the arahant, it is the Pacheka Buddha, the kind of the private Buddha. And then there is the Samma Sambuddha. And the arahant is just someone who practices the Buddhist path, and who takes it all the way to the end. And that's difficult enough already to be an arahant, let alone to be a Samma Sambuddha. And then you have the Pacheka Buddha. The Pacheka Buddhas, well, these are people who achieve full awakening, but they don't go on to teach. So they are like private Buddhas. They just kind of hang out on their own. They just enjoy the meditation. They don't actually do anything beyond just enjoying their own meditation and living as Pacheka Buddhas. And there is the Samma Sambuddha, who is also fully awakened, but they also teach. That is kind of the standard distinction between the three here. And it's kind of interesting. So you can imagine for each one, there's fewer and fewer. So arahants, okay, there's quite a lot of arahants in the world, right, compared to Pacheka Buddhas. And even many more Pacheka Buddhas compared to Samma, Sambuddhas. They are really rare. There's kind of a scale here bit of these things. But why is there such a thing as Pacheka Buddhas? What is the difference between a Pacheka Buddha and a Samma, Sambuddha? Why is it that if you awake to the truth, why is it that you don't teach? And it's kind of one of those strange things. You have all of these enlightened beings in the world, and there are some suttas. There's a sutta in the mid-length saying called the Isigiri Sutta, I think the original word is Isigiri, which means the hill of the sages. It's like this big hill, and there's all these Pacheka Buddhas living on this hill. I don't know why all the Pacheka Buddhas all come to one hill. It's kind of weird, isn't it? All these Pacheka Buddhas hanging out together. I guess they like each other's company, I suppose. I guess that makes sense. We like to be like people. We hang other people who are like us. So why is it that they don't teach? And it's one of those things that actually can be quite difficult to really understand. But it might be that the reason is. If you remember one of the very famous stories of the biography of the Buddha, after the Buddha's awakening, according to his autobiography, he says that Brahma Sahampati, one of these great gods, comes down to the Buddha and begs the Buddha to teach. And prior to that, the Buddha was just thinking, maybe no point in teaching. It's too hard, too difficult. No one will understand anyway, so what's the point of teaching? Okay, let it be. And it was almost as if the Buddha was about to become a Pacheka Buddha. And then this other being intervenes, please come and teach. And I think that maybe there's some truth to that. This is maybe the distinction between the Pacheka Buddha. When you become fully enlightened, it is like you don't really have any motivating forces inside of you anymore. You don't have anything to really drive you because you have achieved everything there is to achieve in the world. There's nothing more to be done. So you don't really look for anything more to do. And because you are perfectly at peace in the way you are, because you're perfectly happy, and because you know that what you have seen is really profound, no one else is very likely to understand it, why should I, there's nothing there to motivate this person to actually do anything. And this is what Ajahn Brahm used to say to me. I thought, yeah, I'm not so sure about that. I'm this really bad disciple. Yeah, I always. and so I like to kind of feel sure about things on my own. But actually, I think there may very well be some truth to that. I don't know if it actually was the Brahma Sahampati who asked the question. It sounds a little bit too convenient for Buddhism if that was the case. But still, that there is something there going on. You need something to drive you, something to give rise to compassion. And this is another important point. I mean, we often think that the Buddha started out with compassion before he became the Buddha. Yeah. The idea is that I'm doing this out of compassion for the whole world. I'm going to find enlightenment and then teach everyone. That is getting things the wrong way around, I think. It's certainly getting the wrong way around, according to the suttas. Because there's nothing in the suttas, nowhere in the suttas, where the Buddha to be says that I do this out of compassion for the world. And it's kind of obvious, because the Buddha to be, first of all, you have to find the solution to the problem. Once you have a solution to the problem, then is the right time to have compassion and help people out. Before you have a solution, how can you, there's no point in having compassion. It's not almost like conceit. If you have compassion at that point, it's like, I'm going to sort everything out and I'm going to kind of help. It's like Superman or something like that. That's not how it works. So the sequence in the suttas is always, the Buddha says, there's a problem in life. Life isn't what it's kind of made out to be. It is actually much more problematic. Okay, let me find a solution. Then he finds a solution. Then Brahma Sahampati or someone comes to the Buddha and says, please teach. There are all these beings in the world who are suffering and having problems. Please teach. Then the Buddha surveys the world and he asks himself, are the people in the world who are ready to understand these teachings? Then compassion arises. Then he teaches. That is kind of the natural sequence of things. That is how it really kind of should be according to how it actually is according to the suttas. So the Buddha, the Sammasambuddha, is different from the Pacheka Buddha in that they get that spark, they get that motivation at the beginning, that gets them, sets them going, that gives rise to the fire of compassion inside. Maybe fire is the wrong word here, but give rise to the compassion inside. And then when that compassion has been born within them, then they start teaching as a consequence. So this is the sequence, and this is how it works. So, the fully awakened Buddha. And then we have this idea of accomplished in knowledge and conduct. And accomplished in knowledge and conduct, we have already talked a little bit about the idea of knowledge. The Panya Vimutti, liberated by knowledge. And very often in the suttas, the word for knowledge here is vijja, and the most important knowledge according to the vijja is always threefold in the suttas. One is the recollection of past lives, the understanding of the idea of rebirth, one of the fundamental insights on the Buddhist path. The second one is the mechanism that drives rebirth, the idea of kamma, why people are reborn and how they are reborn according to their actions and their views. And the last one is the insight into the Four Noble Truths, which is like the arahantship, the full insight into non-self and into the nature of reality. These are the three vijjas in Buddhism, the three knowledges. Absolutely fundamental to the Buddhist teachings. And then there is the conduct. And this is what is so important on one of the very important things on the Buddhist path is the fact that if you really have an insight into reality, it is not as if you have insight and life is just like before. You're just the same person. No, if you have these kind of insights, you are transformed as a human being. And sometimes, I don't know if you have seen this, but sometimes you can, the internet is a very interesting place because you get everything. The internet is kind of full of everything, right? And everything, you have never, if it wasn't for the internet, you wouldn't have known that these beings existed in the world, because when you get 7 billion people crammed into one place, you get to see everything in humanity, which is kind of very exciting and very interesting. And so on the internet, you find all these arahants, And you know, you go to their website, and it's Arahant so and so. Yeah, yeah. I went to a retreat. Yeah, it was a really good retreat. Got some good meditation. I became an Arahant. And then after becoming an Arahant, I went back and, you know, got back to my wife and back to work, you know, and back to the ordinary things again. No, it's not like that, right? It's complete delusion. This is a very common delusion in the world. Yeah, these kind of ideas. If you become an Arahant, you are transformed. Your conduct, your entire being is very different from what you were before. For one thing, in the suttas, it says that you cannot live an ordinary household life anymore. You're finished with the household life when you become an Arahant. And the household life is defined as living in a house and storing up things. You don't store up things. Why? Well, because you're not really interested in the future. Yeah, the future is not where you find happiness. You find happiness in the present by meditation or whatever. So you are transformed as a human being. And this is why we can actually have some access to these teachings right here and right now. You know, when you are looking for a teacher, you're looking for who is an Arahant in the world, actually, it is at least partly possible to know that through conduct. An Arahant is going to be someone who is kind, right? If someone is a nasty character, unlikely to be an Arahant. So an Arahant is someone who lives very simply. They have renounced things in the world. They don't have, you know, lots of stuff and lots of things. An Arahant is someone who has a lot of clarity about them, a lot of wisdom about them, who can say things that when you think, wow, that was really interesting, that's very different from what I've seen before. An Arahant is someone who is very peaceful. Yeah, they're not very excitable or anything like that. They are kind of very even in their mind and very even in the way they live and the way they are. So there is a way of telling who is an Arahant in the world, and that's really good news. Yeah, because it means that the idea of crazy wisdom is crazy. Yeah, there is no such thing as crazy wisdom. Either you're wise or you're crazy. There's not kind of one, both at the same time. It's a very useful thing to know. Because so many people I know, I find this really kind of almost heartbreaking. Yeah, people say, yeah, oh yeah, this monk. I've heard this said to my face. I know this is exactly what happened. This monk, really cool monk. Yeah, this is an Arahant. But one day, they went out and punched someone else out of compassion, right? And the other one even needed to be punched in the face. And I saw them do that, and this is a real Arahant. This is what Arahants do. And I think, what, are you crazy? What's wrong with you? How can you say these kind of things? Yeah, and I think it's just so terrible, because it's like we are allowing abuse to happen in our society, or in spiritual circles, or in religious circles, because we have some very misguided ideas about what it means to be enlightened. Conduct and insight go together. When someone is an Arahant, they are very, very, they are special. They're not someone who is driven by these ordinary defilements of human beings. And that is a very, very positive thing. And we should be inspired by people's conduct. And when people's conduct is really exceptional and really pure and really beautiful, that's where inspiration should come from. It should not come from these kind of crazy ideas that sometimes people are inspired by. That's really good news, yeah? And if someone really does get angry, if the whole world says that person is an Arahant, but they get angry, and you can see that they get angry, you should have doubts. Yeah? The whole world, they're not really angry, they're just kind of playing out. Yeah, it looks like they're angry, but actually not really angry. Be doubtful when you hear these kind of things. Don't just go along with the majority. Because if you go along with the majority, you're going to be one of those, another sheep in the flock. Yeah, and eventually the leader of the sheep reaches the cliff, and then you're going to go over the cliff as well, because everyone else goes over the cliff. Be the black sheep. It's really good to be black sheep. I've been saying this with you. Black sheep aren't far better than white sheep. White sheep are stupid. That is when they just go, bah, and they follow along, and they all go over the cliff. The black sheep, no, I'm not going to do this. It turns back. It goes a different direction. That's the black sheep. Be a black sheep. That's what I recommend you. Because otherwise, you're going to go where everyone else goes. We all need to think for ourselves. And when we think for ourselves, not in a stupid way, in a smart way, yeah, not in a stubborn way, in a wise way, and when you think for yourself in the right way, not just doing what everyone else does, then you are likely to get somewhere. Conduct is important. The Buddha is holy. Holy is sugata, literally means gone to a good destination. Yeah, good destination means that you have gone to the end of the path or something like that. Sugata, one of the standard kind of phrases in the suttas for the Buddha. The Buddha is a knower of the world. Knower of the world, what does that exactly mean? It means a number, can mean a number of things. One of the things that knower of the world means, it means that you know the world in terms of, you know, different kinds of rebirth and different kinds of realms and maybe the laws of karma, and you kind of know the whole kind of variety of the whole universe maybe, or maybe you know about galaxies. Did the Buddha know about galaxies? I think maybe he did. Yeah, there's some kind of amazing things in the sutta, talking about solar systems and all kind of things. I don't know where he got it from, but it seems to be in there. It's one of those extraordinary things. Anyway, let's not go down that track here. So this is one of the things that it means to know the world. Yeah, you know about all these varieties that are possible in the world. But I think knower of the world is far more important, is the kind of psychological dimension of knowing the world. Because the whole purpose of knowing about rebirth, or knowing about the various realms of existence, or even knowing about galaxies or whatever, the whole purpose of it is really to understand happiness and suffering. That is the point. So when the Buddha talks about knowing the world, what it really refers to is having a full understanding of what is possible in terms of happiness and suffering in the world. Because sometimes we are kind of trapped in the human realm and we think that the human realm is all that is possible. But we actually need to, maybe there is more to this world than the human realm. Actually, we know that already. Animals, right? They are kind of more straight away. So that kind of broadens our perspective a little bit. But maybe there's more than that. Maybe there's a vast number of possibilities. And the only way you are going to know how the world, what the world really is like, whether you should carry on being in this world, whether you should look for another rebirth, how all of these things work out, the only way you can have a full understanding of the full scope of happiness and suffering is to understand all of these things. If you don't understand all of these things, if you think that life is limited to the human realm and to this one existence that we have, well, then you might be in for a nasty surprise. You have to have the whole bird's eye view. The Buddha is a knower of the world in this very broad sense, of standing back, seeing everything. And only then, when you stand back and see everything in this way, you have a full oversight over the idea of suffering and happiness, only then can you make a wise decision about whether this needs to be stopped. Is there a corner in this world where I can kind of hang out forever and be happy forever? Is there no such corner? Is it possible to end rebirth and just hang out with God, with God or Mahabrahma or whatever forever after? What is actually possible in this existence of ours? And only when you understand all the possibilities and understand all the suffering and happiness inherent in all of that, can you make a decision about what you should be doing. This is another way of understanding the world. But there's still another way of understanding the world. And this is to understand that really what the world comes down to for us as individual human beings is, again, the five khandhas, the five aspects of personality. This is really what the world is at the end of the day. The Buddha says in a very famous sutta called the Rohitasa Sutta, where there's a fellow called Rohitasa. Ajahn Brahm calls him the first astronaut in the world because he kind of tries to walk to the end of the universe. He had his very long steps, long strides, right? Really, really long step. Each step kind of went from one ocean to the other ocean. So he was going to walk. I'm going to walk to the end of the world. And then he goes to the Buddha. I tried to walk to the end of the world. I couldn't do it. And the Buddha says, well, you tried in the wrong way. Surprise, surprise. And the Buddha says to him, the world is found in this fathom-long body with its consciousness. The end of the world is found in this fathom-long body with its consciousness. The beginning of the world is found in this fathom-long body with its consciousness. The path leading to the end of the world is found right here. So what does that mean? Well, what it means is that whatever experience we have of the world, whatever even when we talk about galaxies, even when we talk about the world so-called outside of us, it is a personal experience that belongs to the five khandhas. Because it is all about how we perceive things, yeah? And that perception exists in your mind. You perceive the world in this way. So ultimately, when we talk about understanding the world, there is really only one world that matters, and that is the world of personal experience. Is there a world outside of that? Maybe, maybe not. It's very hard to say what that is. We don't even know what it is, because everything is really personal experience. So in the end, knower of the world, if you want to know the whole universe, it is enough to know your own five khandhas. Isn't that kind of cool? I find that so amazing. And what that means, of course, is that if you understand your own five khandhas fully, you have understood everything there is to understand. There's nothing more to understand beyond that, because in the end, everything comes back to personal experience. Everything external is also really, in the end, personal experience. And this is why, when you have a full insight into the five khandhas that is yourself, actually, it is a much more of a broader insight than that. It is really an insight into everything. And that is why you can come to very profound conclusions about, basically, about, whether there is a God in the world and these kind of things. Is there a permanent creator God or is there not? Well, actually, that is part of the insight you have when you understand the five khandhas fully, that you know about these kind of issues. So this is what the Buddha has seen. So you can see how the Buddha is kind of beginning to look like a pretty awesome character when you see him in this way. Wow, we still haven't finished the Itipiso formula, but that is at least the beginning of the Itipiso formula. We're going to continue that and finish it off tomorrow morning, but it's a good start. And I want to look at this in a bit detail, because I think these things are very important, and they actually matter quite a lot for our ability to make spiritual progress, to really understand a bit about the Buddha. It's so easy to chant these kind of things and in Pali, in English or whatever, but not really have a full grasp of what actually is implied by them. Anyway, that is all for now. So have a nice afternoon, and then we'll come back again at 7 o'clock this evening here.